Anarchy and Yaks. Who does he think he is? Why don't you get off the couch?
With tasty philosophy and deep yaks, this is Nick Hazelton with the Narco Yakitalism.
Hey there, guys. This is Nick Hazelton, the Anarcho Yakitalist. I'm here with the 64th episode of Anarcho Yakitalism. Today is not going to be a hard-hitting intellectual episode, but it's going to be a good one. This is the only episode I've done on FiendPhone for the show. I'm hoping it won't be the last. I need equipment to record with FiendPhone, so right now I typically use Skype and a separate program that records the Skype call. Anyway, I've been listening to a lot of the survival podcasts for a while now, and one thing I like about Jack Spirko is that he likes to express his gratitude for his situation in life. I find that very valuable. And he's been bringing it up a lot more recently during the holidays, because it's a time where you can lay back a bit and celebrate with friends and family. I'd like this episode to be kind of a testament to how grateful I am for our guest today, and you're going to hear a few stories from him. He's the man who built this podcast with me and made me an anarcho-yakitalist. I'm extremely grateful to finally get him on the show, so without further ado,
I've got Michael W. Dean on with me today. I'm super excited about this. You guys probably know who Michael Dean is from, I've talked about him a lot. I've got him up on the website. I do the Freedom Fiends with Michael. Michael is the guy who helped me set up the podcast.
Yay.
And I've been wanting to have him on for a long time, but he's been sick. But now you're fine, or you're getting better. You're not quite fine.
You said I've been sick.
You're getting there.
I'm sick. No, sick. It sounded like
sick.
I'm
sick.
I'm eating, man.
Sorry.
I was ready to do this interview like 2 hours ago, but you had tech problems. What were your tech problems, and how did we solve them?
My tech problem was I updated to Windows 10 on my laptop, which is where I do all of my recording and stuff. And then I haven't used FiendPhone since I did it. And when I tried to connect to the FiendPhone thing, the server, it just stopped working. FiendPhone crashed, and it was very irritating. And so we went back and
did you go back to Windows 7?
There you go. Yeah. And now it works fine. It's working perfectly.
Yeah. I don't think your computer has enough memory to run Windows 10. I think you need to get a new computer for Christmas, and we can talk about that, about what your list of demands should be for a computer later.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And, if you guys would like to help me get a computer, donate.
No, donate to me. His parents are going to buy him one. No, I'm kidding. Taking money from
teenagers.
They
probably will buy me one.
They probably will. Yeah.
It's Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So getting into this, I mean, Michael is very impressive. I don't need to like inflate your ego, but
I'll take it.
I respect you as a person in the Liberty Movement who has done quite a bit. There's only two radio stations that I know of on terrestrial radio that talk about libertarian ideas.
Radio shows. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. And that would be the Freedom Fiends and Free Talk Live. And so
we're both on. It's surprising that we're on stations. Freedom Fiends are on 32 stations and Free Talk Live's on like 150. I can't believe we're on any stations, because most of the stations that both shows are on, all the stations we're on, and most of the ones that Free Talk Live are on, are conservative, right-wing, commercial radio stations that, you know, I mean, that we're sandwiched between like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck a lot of times, and we don't like those people. I mean, I don't know if we hate them. We just I disagree with them, but you know, I disagree with Bernie Sanders too. But I'm just amazed. I'm blessed and amazed and like blown away. I'm surprised that there's actually true voluntarist, anarcho-capitalist, libertarian talk 7 days a week from two different shows on terrestrial commercial conservative station. Now, Free Talk Live is on about five stations that are liberal too, which is kind of neat and weird. But yeah, it's mostly conservative. I'm getting a little echo from you. I think it's leaking through your headphones. You got to put them on tighter. You know, I got put on this CPAP machine. I don't know if you heard me talking about that last night. It's basically like, yeah. I have so many illnesses and like nobody knows what to do about them. Doctors are baffled. But one of the things I have is sleep apnea and central sleep apnea, which means that I stop breathing in my sleep, which central sleep apnea can kill you. So I had to get a machine to help me breathe. And I finally got it after like 6 months of fighting with the insurance company. Got it yesterday, slept with it last night, and it's really weird. But yeah, I realized I have to like, I'm gonna have to shave because and I never grow a beard, but I'm kind of scruffy sometimes, but I'm gonna have to like shave every other day probably to keep my skin smooth on my face. So the mask will form a tight seal on my face. Cause otherwise it's like wind blowing past your eyes, waking you up while you're asleep. And you know, Hitler, the reason he had that goofy mustache was so his mustache would fit inside a gas mask. So there is a precedent with this, but it's not a good one.
That's weird. I didn't know that about Hitler. That's weird.
Yep.
That's
crazy. Yeah. That's crazy.
So why did Chaplin have it then?
I think he was making fun of Hitler. I know that. Well, yeah. I know he did a movie where he played Hitler. Basically, it was called The Great Dictator, I think. And he had that mustache in it, but I think he just had the mustache was kind of stylish too. And now it's like, no one would ever dare have that style cause everyone thinks of Hitler. But, yeah, Chaplin was it was an anarchist too. Do you know that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And like got basically thrown out of America for being anti-war.
Wow. That's crazy.
Have you seen the movie Chaplin, where Robert Downey Jr. plays him?
It's
amazing. He really should have won an Oscar for that and didn't. But yeah, he did a great job with it. You should check it out.
All right, I'll put it in the show notes.
So are you following this whole like some guy has basically stepped forward claiming to be Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin? And have you heard about this?
I like saw a headline.
Yeah, I've spent like 5 hours today reading everything I can on it and watching videos on it. I'm convinced the guy is not Satoshi Nakamoto and that he is maybe insane. And like, why would you do that? I mean, and apparently he has a bunch of Bitcoin, like millions of dollars worth. So it doesn't look like he's trying to do it as a financial scam. It looks like he's trying like – you know, people that just want to lie and pretend they're something they're not, like he's one of those. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I would, come out and say, I invented Bitcoin.
Well, also, like, he's Australian, and the Australian, like, tax police raided him hours after that article came out.
Right. So it's just not... It's not a good idea.
And they found his address off the voter rolls there, and voting is mandatory by law in Australia.
Jeez. Say anything on the internet, they'll just find you.
I know.
Crazy. Yeah. I think they made it. I don't know if they passed the mandatory voting here in Oregon or not.
They tried? Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow. I don't see that passing in America.
No, it's weird because they're going to do it through the when you sign up to get your driver's license.
Oh, like you can't drive unless you vote. Okay, yeah. That's different than in Australia. It's like you go to jail if you don't vote.
Oh, geez. That's man.
But I think that old people are exempt from it, which is funny.
Yeah. Grandfathered in, literally.
Obama wants mandatory voting.
Mm-hmm.
He commented on it after Oregon. It says it's automatic voter registration. When you register your car or get a license in Oregon, you're automatically,
I don't think you have
to vote, but you're automatically registered to vote.
Mm.
Yeah.
Weird.
So anyway,
I wanted to have you tell the story of the fiends and a little bit of your backstory.
All right.
So that if anybody on my listenership that doesn't listen to the fiends and doesn't know you, can learn about that a little bit.
All right.
And I love your story and I've heard it a few times from you. And it's just fantastic. So, like, yeah, just start from the beginning.
My story. I'm like, which story did I tell you? Not that there's false ones. They're all true. But it's like, you know, if someone said, like, so tell me about your life and how you got up to here, I could tell it three different times and have so many – there's so much to it that there'd be so many details left out of one versus the other. I guess I'll start with – well, I actually have an – this will help me. I have an email. Somebody wrote me the other day. So I do a lot of stuff that a lot of people who are into the Freedom Fiends have no idea about my backstory. Like, you know, they think that the only thing I've ever done is the Freedom Fiends, and they know me as this libertarian guy. So I've kind of always been into liberty, but I wasn't always a libertarian. I basically became a libertarian around 2006. My adult daughter died of leukemia. And she never smoked pot. She didn't like pot. She thought people that smoked pot were weird. And she, like, you know, she went to church and she was kind of square in a good way. And when she got leukemia, a doctor, she was getting so sick from the chemotherapy that a doctor recommended to her to break the law and smoke pot to get some relief. And she did. And the thought that someone could throw her in a cage for getting relief from dying of cancer pain just made me insane is not the right word, but livid. And I never really thought about laws before. I used to be a heroin addict. I got clean in 2001. I used to be a heroin addict, and I wasn't even aware really in my heart of hearts that heroin was illegal. I mean, I remember being in San Francisco and being in a coffee shop and talking to this girl that I knew. And she's like, you know, you have a syringe behind your ear, right? And I had like an insulin syringe full of heroin with a cap on the needle just behind my ear. Like you'd put a pencil behind your ear, you know, and I had long hair, but like it was sticking out. And I was in a coffee shop getting coffee. And this, you know, like I was like, oh, okay. And I took it and put it in my pocket. I mean, that's how I lived when I was doing drugs. Somehow, like, you know, I lived this charmed existence and never ended up in jail for it. I've never been arrested. I spent the night in still getting an echo from you. Do you have your GTN feed all the way down on the Fiend phone? Yes. All the way down. Like, make sure it's all the way down. Check. Yeah, still getting a little bit of it. I think it's your fluffy, long yak hair is making a little gap under your headphones.
Yeah.
Maybe turn down.
I could switch to, like, little, small earbuds.
No, earbuds leak more. You're wearing headphones is good. Make sure they're tight on your head, and then just turn down your volume a tiny bit of what you're hearing of me. Okay, so anyway, you know, I never really thought about drugs being illegal, even when I was using them. Never been arrested. Spent the night in jail once for drunk in public, like 30 years ago, but never been arrested. I wasn't arrested. They would arrest you now and fine you for that now, but then they just, you know, they just put you in. they were trying to protect me from myself, not collect revenue like they would now. I guess maybe, I don't know. So yeah, like I started really thinking. I never thought about laws basically until my daughter died of leukemia, and you know, pot gave her some comfort while she was dying. So, and she was 24, and I had her when I was 18. I'm 51 now. So that made me think about that. But then I really didn't that was when I started looking at laws, and I was like, you know, who should I vote for? And my wife and I were doing this like kink podcast, and I was afraid that like some Republican was going to get elected and like outlaw free speech. Cause that's around the time that Bush, like, there was this law that Bush pushed through that like was supposed to be to protect against child pornography, but it basically like made anything, even like adult consensual, whatever, on the internet, like quasi legal. If you didn't have like written records of everyone involved, you know, and like we did an audio only thing, but I was worried like this might become illegal. Like I'd never thought before of like something I do could become illegal. And I started looking at like who to vote for. And I was thinking of voting for a Democrat because like I was like, oh, they're cooler. They're better with free speech. And my wife was like, no, they're not. They're all horrible. And I realized like there was nobody to vote for. You know, there's a book by the guy who wrote Moon is a Harsh Mistress. What's his name?
Isn't that Heinlein?
Yeah. Heinlein wrote this book called Glory Road. And the first line of it, of that book, is, I was 21 and couldn't figure out who to vote against, or something like that. You know, it's about like coming of age and being disillusioned with the politics of the world. Like, you know, there's no right answer. And I wasn't 21, I was like 41. But that line really summed up where I was at when I started looking at politics. So shortly after that, someone tried to break into our house while I was home. I was really sick. I had a flu. My wife had gone to the store to get, you know, like chicken soup and NyQuil for me. And I had headphones on, but I heard my cats knocking stuff over, running. And I turned around and like, there was somebody trying to like pry a window open and get in the house. And I actually went out and confronted the guy. And it was mistaken identity. Like, I called the cops and the cops actually showed up and they actually caught the guy. It was this like Mexican day worker, labor worker guy that like, what was going on was all the houses in our neighborhood were built from the same plan and looked identical. And we had like a covenant that you have to sign to like you can't paint your own house. They paint them all the same color, even though you own the house. Which I didn't like. It's kind of like another level of government that you agree to, but they can change the terms at any time, so which is not a real contract. But, you know, it is legally. So the police caught the guy. He was basically like, what it was somebody like four or five houses away. A landlord had rented a house that was identical to ours to like 30 illegal immigrant day worker Mexican gardener guys. Like 30 people living in a house like the size where my wife and I were living. And I don't think they all had keys. So, you know, he came stumbling home drunk. I could smell the alcohol on him from 20 feet away. And he thought it was his house and tried to get in. So I don't know how long he spent in jail. Probably not long. I think the police, I don't know what happened, but I got really freaked out. I'd actually had one time before when I was, I've been ripped off before. Like, when I was in a band back in the '80s, like we rented this practice studio somewhere in this crappy part of town, and somebody actually like cut through the wall and ripped all the bands off. Like they took, you know, we thought we were secure cause we could lock the stuff in there, but it was, the walls were made of like plasterboard, and somebody went in there with a portable saw and just like sawed a door in all of the rooms and just took a truck and took everyone's equipment, and we had no insurance. So I've had that happen. I had, when I lived in Virginia, that was in San Francisco. When I lived in Virginia, I came home one day and my roommate was like red and panting, and I'm like, what happened, man? And he's like, oh, I just came home and there was some kid here stealing our records, and I chased him out. I was like, wow, you know. And I've been mugged. I've had a knife to my throat in New York City buying drugs on the street, but this somehow seemed more close to home and scared me more. Like, this was, you know, someone was coming in our house, and the guy wasn't very badass and he wasn't much of a criminal. And, you know, like the police, he still had this stick in his pocket that he was using to pry. You know, it's like you're carrying a burglary tool that's evidence that can convict you, that looks like everything on the ground if you drop it, but you don't drop it. You stick it in your pocket. That's not smart criminal masterminding. You know, when someone tried to break into our house, I got freaked out. And I was like, I said to my wife, like, honey, we're getting a shotgun. And she didn't like the idea. She was like, well, you know, getting a gun is kind of admitting the world's a bad place. And I said, sometimes the world is a bad place. I love you. I want to protect you. I want to protect me. I want to protect our cats. I want to protect our property. And we're getting a shotgun. And, you know, unlike a lot of males who'd be like, yes, dear, whatever you say, we won't get a gun. I was like, no, we're getting a gun. Like, it didn't matter to me that she said no. It was too important to let emotions rule it. And some would say, like, you know, oh, you're a bad husband, or you're a, you know, anti-feminist, or you're a misogynist because you didn't take your wife's, you know, opinion into account in a house you share. And I'm like, this was too important not to. So a couple of days later, we went and got a shotgun and we went to a gun range and actually took a lesson from like, we took a gun safety lesson. We paid and took gun safety and how to use a shotgun. We fired a, you know, 20 or 30 shells worth of shotgun rounds. We went back to the house and my wife was like, I loved that. I want to do more of that. So we got a little, we got a rifle, 22 rifle. Then we got a couple of handguns and, you know, it's just grown since then. And, my wife and I both carry guns. Like, she will not leave home without a gun. You know, she got over her, I don't like guns, guns are bad, to the point where she's like, I like to live and I'm not going to let someone take my life. So I'm carry a gun. So I ordered a couple books about guns. Like when we only had the shotgun, I ordered the only book I could find on Amazon about shotgunning. And it was actually about turkey hunting. And it was this really square book. It had nothing about self-defense in it, but it was, you know, talked about different kinds of shotguns and chokes and shot and different things you can put in a shotgun. And on Amazon, it said people who bought this book also bought, and there was a book called You and the Police by someone named Boston Tea Party. And I ordered that book too. It was cheap. I bought it. I think I bought it used. And so I get that book and it's not very long. It's like 100 pages or less. And it's not small print. It's like, I read it in one sitting. By the end of that sitting, I'd gone from like statist to deep minarchist. You know, I was like, that book just convinced me, you know, government is immoral. You don't need rulers. And, you know, there shouldn't be any gun control. There shouldn't be any gun registration. And people can manage themselves better than any government can manage themselves. I still didn't get rid of the last, like, you know, people say, and this is really true, I found, is like, you can go from, you know, statist to minarchist in one sitting. And then it takes a few years sometimes to go from minarchist to anarchist. Like, you know, the first 999 miles of the journey are easy and the last mile is hard for a lot of people. And it was for me. I still clung to that, like, well, but without the government, we can't do it. You know, and eventually, like, the longer you cling to those illusions, the more you find yourself not being consistent when you try to explain to yourself or others how certain things would work without government or with government or why there should be any government. You know, did you find that? Did you go all in one trip, Nick?
Young Nick? That's interesting. Yeah, I kind of started out as a minarchist because I learned about libertarianism through my dad when I was like 12. So I got into libertarianism. And so I was a minarchist kind of off the bat for, I guess, a few years. I wasn't really into politics. Then I got super into politics and it took about 6 months to find the Freedom Fiends. And after listening to the Freedom Fiends for like, I think it was 3 months, you guys convinced me.
Yeah. We have this streaming link. It's 24/7 random loop of all of our episodes, like all 800 and something episodes. And I've been giving that out a lot to people, and like it generally only has between like 5 and 10 listeners on it at a time, but sometimes some of them are on for like 3 to 7 days, and I'm like, what are those people doing? Are they just like voluntarily brainwashing themselves, like re-educating themselves in one sitting? They must be.
That's basically what I did. You had a stream like that on TuneIn.
Yeah.
When I first started listening, because that's what I was listening to.
Yep. And you still can tune in. Is if you're on Android, you go to TuneIn. If not, you just go to the Freedom Fiend site over on the left side for PC and Mac. It's the link that has the pretty girl with the Freedom Fiends t-shirt on near the top left over on the sidebar. So, that's how I became an anarchist. And by the end of reading that book in one sitting, like, and I'll tell you why that book's unique and people should read it. You and the Police by Boston Tea Party. The whole cop block movement is based on that book. And, I knew that from like, I read that book predates Cop Block by several years. Everything Cop Block does is described in that book. And I've like talked to the Cop Block guys about it. I don't think they want to come out and say, yes, we got the whole idea from that book. But they're like, they answered like, yeah, we really like that book. You know, it basically, you know, tells you to, question police when they pull you over, to ask, am I being detained or am I free to leave? You know, like all of the basic stuff that Cop Block does, to film the police. And this book was written like before everyone had phones that could film. Like, you know, he recommended like getting a portable video camera to keep in your car. And he recommended things that were mind blowing to me. Okay. Here's the thing that really like was the paradigm shift for me reading that book in one sitting, that just warped me in a good way. Okay. We had guns at the time. We had handguns at the time. We could not legally leave our house with them loaded. You know, we couldn't carry them. So like, we're totally safe in the house with guns. We can protect ourselves, but you know, we can't go get a burrito and protect ourselves on the way there and back. If we want to go shoot at the shooting range, we have to have the gun with a trigger lock on it in a locked box with the ammunition in a separate locked box in the car. That's the California law. And it became increasingly frustrating to us as we really internalized, like had guns, lived with guns, and really internalized, we should have these on us at all time, and California doesn't want us to. So Boston Tea Party was the founder of the Free State Wyoming, of Free State Wyoming, which was basically when the Free State Project started. What it was an essay that this guy Jason Sorens wrote, and he invited people to vote on what state to do it in. And there were 10 states that people picked, and New Hampshire was number one, and that won. So a lot of people moved there, and that's a much bigger movement than Free State Wyoming. But Wyoming was overwhelmingly number two. You know, it came in like almost number one, but it was number two. And then there were like 8 other states. So, and Oregon was one of them, and Idaho was one of them. And, I think New Mexico might've been one of them. Some of the people that voted for Wyoming, like, wouldn't move to New Hampshire. They're like, no, we're Western people. We're going to stay here and start our own thing. And Boston Tea Party and this guy named Paul Bonneau and a few other people, Mama Liberty, who's in the Guns and Weed movie, you know, they were early adopters of it, but Boston Tea Party was the founder of it. So in that book, You and the Police, like it basically talks about Free State Wyoming. And at the end of it, it gives their website. And I got on the website at like 5 in the morning when I finished the book and started talking to Mama Liberty, who was up. And by 6:30 in the morning, I was waking my wife up and saying, we're moving to Wyoming. And she's like, what? Huh? Okay. And like 9 months later, we lived here. We'd sold our house and moved here and bought a house. So the other thing that was important in that book for me was that it talked about open carry, you know, the idea of that there are places in America where you can strap a gun to your hip, not conceal it, and walk around with it legally loaded, protecting yourself without a permit. I did not know this thing existed. Like, he kept talking about open carry in the book, and I had to look it up, and I was just, my jaw dropped. I was like, wait, what? What? And, you know, Wyoming is one of the states where you can do that. And he talked about like these ways to get around the law. And the thing is too, like you could tell that the guy writing the book, you know, he puts a lot of his personality in everything he writes. You read his book and you did an interview with him with me, right?
Yeah, I hopped on when you guys did the interview.
He was really touched. I mean, because you're his target audience for that book. That book, what's it called? Modules for Manhood. It's part one of a 3-part series he's writing of like, you know, and I think like what he's done is he's written all these books on how to secede and how to like avoid the government. And some are even seem like, you know, fiction books about how to have armed revolution. And like none of it's come to pass. And after 15 years of writing books, I think he was like, well, that didn't work. I'm going to write books for young men and try to influence them to be better young men, which is a good tack to take, I think. But he was talking like I could tell reading this book. I'd seen books before about how to circumvent the law, but they all looked like they were written for real criminals. You know, I'd read Abbie Hoffman steal this book. I'd read some book, self-published book 20 years ago on how to like disappear and create a new identity, but they all seemed like they were aimed at people who were doing actual crimes, like real crimes. And I'd read this book called Hardcore Self-Defense from Paladin Press, which tells you how to dispose of bodies, among other things. But there was this thing in Boston's book. He said in You and the Police, he was like, well, you know, if you're in a state where open carry is legal, or if you're in a state where open carry is not legal, basically he was telling you how to carry a gun in your car somewhere it might not be legal. And what he said was, basically get a lockable briefcase, have it sitting on the passenger seat next to you in the front seat, open, have your gun in it. You know, so if, you know, some criminal tries to run you off the road, you can grab it quickly if you need it. But if the police pull you over, he said, just lock it, just close the briefcase and lock it. And he said, practice doing it so it doesn't look suspicious from a car behind you, you know, like do it without moving your shoulders. And he said that there's a lot more protection from police searches of a locked briefcase than there is just of the car in general. Like the police can pull you over and it's pretty easy for them to get you out of the car and then search you without probable cause for their own protection, they say. And then they can usually search in the car without a lot of probable cause or with limited probable cause. But to get inside a locked box is a lot more of a legal uphill battle for a cop. And the idea of like this guy who I would describe Boston as square in a good way. I've met him and hung out with him. I consider him a friend. But even before I met him, like I could tell from this book, like this was not a guy who was committing real crimes. This was not a guy who was even smoking pot, which is not a real crime. This was a square, you know, kind of cowboy who also uses encryption on his computer and wants to circumvent being told what to do. And it just seemed like a lot of what he was doing was a lot less theoretical. Like a lot of libertarians, like I encountered, like Libertarian Party stuff, they're like, well, if we get enough people together and we vote, we can repeal some of these laws. And Boston's like, F that. I'm just going to carry a gun whether you say I can or not, and I'm going to get away with it, you know? Or here's how one might theoretically do that. Nod, nod, wink, wink. So that's part of my story. I guess other parts of my story, I mentioned that I do a lot of things that a lot of people who listen to The Fiends might not know about. I'm a documentary filmmaker. Made my first film in the year 2000. I've made several movies since then. They all have distribution. I've made money at all of them and sold them and given them away, which is something I kind of pioneered. Like before there was even something called Creative Commons, I called my DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist DVD, DIY or Die, Burn This DVD, and invited people to, I copyrighted it, but said anybody who buys a copy of it can burn 10 copies of it and give them away or sell them for a dollar. And that's not quite Creative Commons, and it's certainly not BIPCOT from BIPCOT.org, which is my new license, which allows reuse by anyone except governments. And I'm strongly encouraging everyone to use that license. I think it's the best intellectual property license out there.
I'm actually thinking about going to it, because my objection was, well, I want school teachers to use my work, but if I just put on, like, I'll just do the BIPCOT thing and then just say
you could make your own exception. Yeah, and exactly. or you could not put that on and let them use it and then just be free to make fun of them. Because really that's the only recourse. There's no legal recourse with the BIPCOT license. If someone from governments use it, then you know you can make fun of them. But yeah, of course teachers aren't going to want to use stuff if you're going to make fun of them. But I also left it vague intentionally what defines the government use. You know, I mean, I don't know. Is a school teacher in a public school government use? Maybe, maybe not. I would certainly say that, like, you know, the FBI having they could buy a copy of something that's BIPCOT covered, but if they made copies of it for internal use, they'd be violating it. You know, my Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD is in the Quantico Virginia FBI library. I got a Google alert for it that it's in their library, and I searched it. So I don't know if it's on there as, you know, I don't know if it's in there because it's gun training and the FBI are interested in having everything they can on gun training, or if it's like these are the kind of people you should be watching out for. Could be both. I don't know. So I make documentary films. I write books. I've written a bunch of books, done it for a living, nonfiction books, how-to books, on usually on media production. And, you know, I'm not talking like self-published through, you know, like print on demand. Like this is, I've been doing this since before there was print on demand. And, you know, like some of them were published by the biggest textbook publisher in the country. And, you know, I don't pay to do it. I get advances and royalties on them. So that's part of what I did for a living for a long time. I haven't done that in a while. I really don't want to write anymore. I like talking a lot more than writing. Writing is a lot of freaking work, man. It really is. Mm-hmm. And when you're writing, when you're dealing with, you know, a company, you're dealing with an editor too, which I got really good at doing, but it's like my stuff's weird in ways that I have to explain to editors like, okay, no, that's not a mistake. I did that intentionally. I'm doing it consistently and for purpose. And here's why, you know, and some editors are cool with that. Some aren't. The thing I played in a band, called Bomb and a few other bands. Bomb was a really good band. We were signed to Warner Brothers. We toured America 6 times. We toured Europe once. I toured Europe with my DIY Die film too, and toured America with it, Europe and America. So I've kind of done like the most independent forms of media you can and mainstream commercial big business media with the following mediums, you know, with writing, with filmmaking, and, you know, with music, and now with radio and podcasting. Like all four of those media, you know, like I've put out records where we paid to have them pressed. We didn't even have enough money to make covers, to have covers printed with them. You know, we did 7-inch vinyl records. And then we'd like have our friend that works at Kinko's at the night shift, like run us off 1,000 covers on stock card paper, one color, black and white. And then we'd have a party and buy people beer and have them sit around with razor blades and plastic bags and make covers and put the records together. Like that's as do it yourself as you can be, you know, that's as DIY as you can be. And then I've been signed to a major label, and then I've done stuff in between, like been signed to independent labels where, you know, like the major label gives you an advance and then ruins your life and puts the record out. The you pay for yourself and have the beer party costs you money, but it's the most satisfying thing you ever do. And then the independent label does not give you an advance, sometimes gives you a royalty, actually puts your record out, but then usually goes out of business owing you money. So, you know, I've done that with music. I've done it with podcasting and radio. You know, doing a podcast is as DIY as it can be. And then now we're on commercial radio, you know, syndicated over satellite. I don't make much money at it though. I'm not great at monetizing things I do because I have integrity. Really. It's like to make the Fiends commercial, I would have to take ads for anything. And I've turned down advertisers that I don't believe in to the point where like what I've done for the past 2 years is since we got on radio, really, is just we don't take ads. I mean, I would consider an ad if someone wanted to buy one. But generally, I just give the ads away to people like antiwar.com and FIJA, you know, Fully Informed Jury Organization, FIJA.org, Fully Informed Jury Association.org. You know, people that help, and just an ad for like, use Bitcoin, check it out at Bitcoin.org. You know, like just stuff that helps liberty. And then like use some of the other ad space for like comedy, like the Cat Muff ad.
Yeah.
Which like, there is so much value to me to like the fact that that ad plays on 32 commercial radio stations. And whenever there's an election, it's playing before and after actual ads for actual candidates. And people listening are scratching their head going, wait, what? Huh? Is that real? You know, the ability to do that is more important to me than the ability to make a living doing a show, you know, and there are people to make a living doing a show like Free Talk Live, make a living doing a show, but they have to hustle hard. They were also the first adopters. They've been doing it for 10 years on radio. We've been doing it for 2 years. So, and we've been doing the podcast for 4 years, but yeah, I've basically got to the point where I'm accepting donations and I'm hustling for donations, but I've kind of given up on trying to monetize the show. It's a labor of love.
Yeah. And I mean, you sell buttons, but you don't make a whole lot of money off that, right?
I barely. No, I would say I lose money at buttons. I make like $1.70 on each pack of 10 that I sell for $10 with when you factor in the postage, which keeps going up, and I keep keeping the price at $10. But eventually the postage is going to go up to the point where I'm going to have to raise the price on it. But so it's $10 for 10 buttons. The buttons cost like 50 cents each to make. So it's basically like $5 worth of buttons and then like $2.70 worth of postage. And then, you know, like 80 cents for the envelope and then like 10 cents for the plastic bag it's in. Mm-hmm. It's close to like, I think I'm making less than $3 per sale, but it doesn't cover, you know, the work to stuff the envelopes and go to the post office. And the post office is trying to make it so I have to stand in line to mail every one of these. But for now, I can still drop them into a street box because they're light enough. But they are trying to get to the point where everything that's not a letter has to, they're trying to put themselves out of business because they have a monopoly. So, but the thing is, I also give a lot of them away. Like, okay, if somebody makes a $5 donation to the Freedom Fiends, I write to them and say, hey, I want to send you some buttons. What's your address? That's a loss. I lose money on that. I gave away 3,000 buttons at Porkfest. Those were the smaller buttons, which were 33 cents each. But, you know, what's that? 330. That's like $1,000 worth of buttons I gave away. Whenever anybody makes a donation to the Fiends of any amount, I offer them buttons. And, you know, I give buttons generally to people that do me favors. I give buttons to all the Fiend hosts, you know, so I lose money on buttons.
Yeah, I give them out, though. Yeah, every time you send me something, I at least give a couple of them away. I like to keep the Guns and Weed one.
Yeah.
I know I have a couple of those, but I've been handing out to my buddies because they dig it. They dig it a lot.
Yeah, and I also do things like, you know, like I bought you a mic or two. I think I gave you a computer that I wasn't using. I bought mics for a few other Fiends co-hosts. So, you know, any money I get goes back into the show and back into making the show better, really. So send money, people.
What's the URL there? Freedom Fiends?
FreedomFiends.com. Just go to any post and at the bottom of it, there's a spinning coin. Click on the spinning coin. It tells you how to send cash or Bitcoin or PayPal. I don't have an address for snail mail on there, but someone actually wrote me recently and wanted to send me a check for $50. And I gave him my P.O. box. I don't like to give out my P.O. box because I don't want weird things to come in my mail. But, you know, yeah. So
anthrax.
Anthrax. Yeah. All right.
So talking about because you kind of gave your story there with how you got the Liberty, but I think one of the most interesting, one of the things you talk about, I think that's super interesting about you is when you were very young, you were getting in a lot of trouble. So you've had this anti-authoritarian spirit since the day you were born.
I remember
that was great.
I remember several instances when I was a teenager of parents not wanting other kids to hang out with me. And it was kind of a feeling I had. But then this one kid told me that his mother said that. And then I actually overheard a mother saying it to her, to my friend too. You got that too?
Yeah. Now that I've dropped out of school, I had one of my buddies say, I don't think you should hang around Nick anymore.
You might drop out of school.
I mean, he
too.
Talked to me anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. That was funny.
Yeah. So what else?
But what did you got sent to a farm school, right?
Yeah, I went to a school called
so bad that you got, sent to one of those schools.
Work farm. When I was 14, it was part. I wasn't really so bad. It was more like, I mean, I was smoking pot, but I wasn't committing crimes. I was not, you know. Oh, actually, I did get caught shoplifting. I shoplifted once and got caught, and that, you know, they kind of did the scared straight thing. They drove me like 10 miles away to the county seat, to the jail, and walked me through and, like, you know, let convicts scare me and then called my parents and they had to come pick me up. You know, I'm glad I didn't get a record from that. And it was like the only time I ever broke bad and I got caught. What was the question? I'm having a brain fart.
That,
oh, was that bad? Oh, I got sent to the school. So, yeah. that was part of it. Like, I think my mother thought I was going to end up really bad, but I don't think I would have. But it was also my parents had just gotten divorced and my mother was kind of having a nervous breakdown. My dad was married to another woman and the other woman didn't want my dad like having custody of me, you know, like he had, you know, like 2 weekends a month or something, but his wife didn't like it. And he let her push him around. So I mostly, you know, was like with my mother alone in this giant house that was comfortable when there were 6 people living there. And then it was just us 2 and it felt like ghostly and empty. And she was having this like slow burn, nervous breakdown. And I think she couldn't handle having me around, you know, at all, combined with like, I was getting in trouble in school and stuff. So she sent me off to this boarding school called the Church Farm School in, what I call now Pennsylvania, which is, it's actually Pennsylvania. The bottom 50 miles, southern 50 miles of Pennsylvania, except for Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, all the rural part in the bottom are very much like Kentucky. They're very redneck, very, kind of mountain-esque, you know, and that's where the Church Farm School is in Paoli, Pennsylvania. And the school is now called the School at Church Farm. I don't know why they changed it. I looked at their website and it looks like the founder has died. The grandfather that started it has died. His son, who was the headmaster when I was there, has died. And that guy's son is the headmaster now. And I think that guy's son is way less religious and way more progressive and like wanted to downplay the religious aspect of the school. Cause the website for it looks very, you know, they still have a church there and they still go to church, but it doesn't look nearly as church centric as it was. And it looks like it's run by a bunch of Obama licking progressives, which, you know, permeate academia at all levels. But, I went to this school for 4 years and then got kicked out for calling the headmaster a fat, bald, overly Christian old fart in a letter I wrote to Mick Jagger telling him to buy the school. The letter got returned unopened as being to the wrong address because we didn't know Mick Jagger's address. So we sent it to the Dakota building where John Lennon lived and asked John Lennon to give it or asked, yeah, John Lennon to give it to Mick Jagger. It got returned unopened and had the school provided us with envelopes that had the address on them, but I didn't write my name on the envelope. So it came back during the summer between 11th and 12th grade and the, you know, summer secretary opened it to see whose mailbox to put it in, read it, gave it to the headmaster. Here's the quote I heard was he said, "Who's Mick Jagger?" Which is kind of surprising for someone that runs a school for boys back then. And he called my parents and asked that I not return. Like, I didn't get kicked out. It was not on my record as being kicked out of school, but they said I couldn't come back. So I went to college when I was 17 through this thing called the PEP, the pre-entrance program, which was basically something for gifted students, but it was kind of abused by my grade school, by my high school, to get rid of gifted students who are troublesome. So the only other person I know from my school, Westfield, New York, Westfield Academy and Central School, who had done this, and she'd done it a year before me, was Natalie Merchant, the singer from 10,000 Maniacs. And she went on later to a pop career of her own. She was smart and troublesome and questioned authority a lot, and they let her go to college at 17. So at 17, I had my own apartment that was paid for 10 miles away from my parents and was on my own and like got my high school diploma through going to college, kind of got like dual credit. Like I had to take a, you know, history course and an English course and a phys ed course and then a couple other whatever I wanted courses in college, and I got college credit for them, but they also counted toward my high school giving me a high school diploma. So I, you know, eighth grade or middle of seventh grade, I went off to the Church Farm School and I hadn't seen any of these people and you know, came back, like got kicked out of school in the summer between 11th and 12th grade, basically called, didn't know what to do, called my guidance counselor I hadn't seen in 4 years at the high school. And he actually like came into his office in the summer and sat with me, and the principal was with him, and they were like, and they invited my mother, and they were like ready to lay out the whole thing about the pre-entrance program. Like they were like, we don't want this guy back. He's too weird and too smart, and he's going to make trouble. He asked too many damn questions. So like basically they railroaded me into this thing that I actually really liked, which was skipping senior year high school. But then at the end of that year of college, I went back to my high school, put on a gown, and graduated with people I hadn't seen in 5 years, you know, in a school I hadn't been to in 5 years, which is pretty cool. So then I went to college for another year and flunked out because I was too busy, like, learning, going to the library to learn to actually pass my classes.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, I always thought that was an interesting story. And that was one of the things I was like, well, hey, Michael did it. I can do it.
Oh, and, no. yeah. You know, I got to say this. So do you have a GED?
No.
You know, most people would say you better get a GED. But you know what? No one's ever asked me to prove that I have a high school diploma. I've never, it's never come up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I've heard that that's what people say. It's like, yeah, they never check.
Yeah, they never check. Like,
they don't care.
They don't care. Yeah. It's, you know, and the world really is headed more towards meritocracy than what it used to be. And meritocracy is a fancy word for, you know, people being judged on merit rather than on a piece of paper. I mean, really, all a high school diploma proves is that you're capable of being a robot. It just proves that you're capable of showing up at the same place at the same time and sitting in neat little rows and reciting not even truths, just, you know, factoids back when asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's just so training for being a soldier or working in a factory.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
That's definitely one of the things that we promote on the Anarcho-Yakitalism podcast.
Yes.
The end of public education.
I was
talking to one of my...
I love that you're still doing your old podcast, I got to say, that you have not pod-faded. Oh. I'm proud of you on that. It's been going for what, a year and a half, 2 years?
Almost a year and a half. We started last July, I think.
Cool. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, I know. I was talking to one of my old school teachers recently. We're actually having an email conversation, and he's like, you shouldn't be able to come to school because you cause trouble. And I was like, what are you talking about? School, like he was saying, yeah, you criticize school, and I've actually criticized his work. We're on good terms. You know? He's not like bitching me out or anything. I'm just like, we just have back and forth every once in a while. But I was like, yeah, I do hate school, and yeah, I am gonna diss you. But I thought that was funny. And I'm surprised that I kept going with it.
Yeah,
it was kind of random how it started. Like, I don't know if I've told
you got school credit for it, right?
I'm sure I
have. Go ahead and tell it again.
Yeah, so it was way back when you started Michael Dean After Dark, and I decided, you know what, I gotta call in, I gotta talk to this guy, because I've been following you for like a maybe even 2 years at that point. And I was excited. Lou Fien was actually, he was the first anarchist friend I had on Facebook, because I was doing something, I was like interviewing a cop in like my eighth grade year. Because I just had the opportunity to do it, and I was like, well, what am I going to ask him? So, and I only listened to the Freedom Fiends and Free Talk Live, so I figured, well, I'm just going to message the Facebook group. And then Lou was like, well, why don't you add me on Facebook and let's talk about it? So I ended up talking to him, and I was like, okay, this is my time to call in, once he was on Michael Dean After Dark with you. And I can't remember what we were talking about.
We took calls for a very short period of time, too. I mean, less than a year, probably less than 6 months. You were lucky.
I know. And so I got on there, and it's like I called you guys up, and then we were talking, and I think we were talking about what the free market, like regulatory agencies, would look like. And I think he said, oh, I like what this kid's saying, but you know what? Your audio sucks.
Yeah.
Get a microphone. And you know what? I'll get you a microphone, and you can start a podcast. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And it went from there.
I was actually going to read this email I wrote somebody at the beginning of the show and then forgot, but part of being good with talking, I find, is no matter how many wormholes you fall down, if you start a story, even if it's an hour later, you have to come back and finish it. So somebody wrote me the other day and asked me, it was somebody who had seen my movie DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist. And he was a photographer. And he wrote me an email and, you know, said, "Hey, I really just want to say, I really liked your movie. You know, what are you up to now?" or something like that. Or maybe he didn't even ask. And I just told him, "I'm doing this thing called the Freedom Fiends." And I talked to him about his photography, and I talked to him about, you know, using the Bipcot license, and just basically just a long email force feeding him a bunch of Michael Dean ideology without him asking, but figuring it was okay, 'cause he'd written me, and it was, 'cause he did. And he wrote back and he said, "I really like your radio. Do you rent it or is it straight up yours?" And I was like, "My radio?" And I'm like looking on my desk at this transistor radio I have. And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "Oh, the online radio station, the Freedom Fiends. It's on some sort of online radio setup. Just wondering if you rented the technology, if it was straight up yours." And it was a really baffling question, but there's no reason that it wouldn't be that baffling to somebody. Like, if I sent you the Freedom Fiend site and I sent you the LRN.fm link and said, "We're going to be on in 5 minutes. I'm going to read your letter on the air. Tune in." So, I mean, this guy's probably 20 years old, 21 years old, like, probably never has listened to talk radio, probably has, you know, heard a radio in the car and listened to music. But like, people don't listen to radio anymore, really. Do you listen to radio, Nick?
I don't usually listen to talk radio.
Yeah.
But sometimes.
Do you listen to the Farm Report on radio? Because yeah. You're a farmer. But the word radio has kind of been co-opted. And I have mixed feelings about this. Like, everybody that does an internet streaming talk show usually has the word radio in the name of their show. But it's not radio. And I kind of feel that that's okay and cool in a way. And it's like, you know, language is as language does, and, you know, you can't centrally plan it. But then there's part of me that's like, wait a minute, I fought and worked and sweated to get on actual radio. And, you know, there's only two shows on actual radio that are doing libertarian, real libertarian stuff. And there's, you know, 100 podcasts that call themselves like Liberty Cap Radio or Liberty Hat Radio or whatever. They all have radio in the name. And, not Liberty Cap. Don't go to that. Okay. So that's the guy that's stalking me. Do you know that guy? Is he stalking you too?
No.
Todd something. Okay. Anyway, now he's going to stalk me more because he'll hear that I actually acknowledged him, where I've just been blocking him. Anyway. So, you know, all these shows have the word radio, or half of them have the word radio in the title. And there's a lot of like streaming servers and streaming networks that have the word radio in them, but they're not radio. Freedom Fiends are on radio. LRN is even on radio. You know, it's like rebroadcast on a bunch of, like, let's say, unlicensed neighborhood stations. It made, at first he was like, I have a question about your radio. And I'm like, what are you talking about? But he's like, the online radio setup. So I wrote him back an email. You know, if you rent the technology, if it's straight up yours, it's actually like, I don't rent. The only thing I rent is the streaming server. I pay $200 a year for that. Everything else either doesn't cost money or doesn't cost much money, or someone else is providing it as part of their business plan, or someone else is providing it as a labor of love. Like the hosting is Derek Slopey is providing the, you know, so here's my answer to him. I said, I don't make a lot of money at it. It doesn't cost me much money. I make a little money at it. Not a ton, but some, but I love doing it. And I sent him a video, that video, the Freedom Fiends Guide to Podcasting. And I said, I have a simple home studio. There's video of it in that video I sent you. The home studio connects via the internet over Fiend Phone to my network, Genesis Communications Network, and to my co-hosts, who all live in different states, and three are in different countries, one in Canada, one in Mexico, and one in Scotland. I have about 15 co-hosts total. We have one or two or three at a time with me usually, when I'm not sick. We do 5 live shows a week, sometimes 6. Plus there's one best of, and then a repeat of that. Lately I've been playing, one of the repeat instead is the old Bad Quaker episode of, I've been rebroadcasting his podcasts that have never been on radio. I've been editing them for radio and then, broadcasting one a week. Let's see. So 7 days a week total. My co-hosts don't even all have a mixer. We made Fiendphone to not need it on the other end. Most of them have less than $100 worth of gear other than their computer. Usually just a good mic, a mic stand, headphones going into their PC, which is running Fiendphone. My network, Genesis Communications Network, they're also Alex Jones's network, has a board operator live during our show. GCN sends us the music cues. It's all, I made all the music, but sent it to them. It's all synced to atomic clocks, perfect timing down to the second. The board op also has a dump button he can hit if anyone cusses, and he makes sure the levels are good. And I want to stress that, like, GCN doesn't pay me. Basically, they pay me in ad time. Like, we get 3 minutes an hour of ad time to do whatever we want with, and, you know, we could sell it, but I give it away and put parody stuff up on it. It costs GCN money to put us on the air. So we are worth something to GCN. In that they're paying a board op, you know, $15 an hour or whatever they pay them to be there for, you know, the 14 hours a week we have a show. So, somebody invests in it and gets something out of it. So, the GCN then sends the show to a satellite, and radio stations take it from the satellite. And GCN pays a lot of money for satellite time. They have, I think, six satellite channels 24/7, and that costs probably tens of thousands of dollars a month. All right, so LRN, Liberty Radio Network, an online radio network, takes the GCN satellite feed and puts it onto the live streaming link I sent you last night. In addition to the commercial stations we're on, there are about 20, let's call them community stations, that run the LRN feed 24/7. That's a polite way of saying, I hear there are pirates, but I don't know any of them. All right. LRN is run at a loss as a labor of love by my friend Ian Freeman, co-host of the daily radio show Free Talk Live. Free Talk Live and the Freedom Fiends are the only true libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, voluntarist radio shows on actual terrestrial radio. They're on 150 stations. We're on 32. They make a good living at it. There are a lot of libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, voluntarist podcasts and internet, quote, radio, unquote, shows. But the word radio is widely misused these days. We are on radio. Free Talk Live are on radio. Most internet radio shows are not. But there are like 10 or 15 podcasts on LRN that are all true liberty stuff. And like I said, those get on some pirate radio. So I guess those are on radio, but I'm differentiating that, like, Free Talk Live and the Freedom Fiends actually, like, somehow are on commercial conservative radio, which is weird. And like, you know, we're on stations with like 1,000 watts or 10,000 watts or one that's 93,000 watts, whereas most, you know, pirate stations are like a watt or 5 watts or something. So, let's see. I take GCN's MP3 archive of each show, edit out the tons of commercials, put in a few of my own commercials, normalize, tag, and upload to the Freedom Fiend site for our podcast every night. I own that site. It's hosted for free by a good friend, the guy who programmed Fiendphone, Derek Slopey, who runs it with a very few other sites on a high-end dedicated server. I also have a streaming server of every Freedom Fiends episode ever playing in a random loop. I pay $203.50 a year for that server. Here's the link for PC and Mac. Here's the link for Android. So that's kind of what the Fiends is, you know, I mean, and it's good to actually read it out loud once to say what it is so people can know, because people might not know, and I assume that they do if they're listening to any part of it or looking at the website or hearing it on LRN or on the streaming feed or on the website. You know, they don't know what it is, and they might be like, what's up with your radio potato? You know, and so that's what's up with my radio potato.
Yeah, I don't remember where we started off with this.
Well, I could be done, or you could. I mean, that would be a good full circle because that kind of went back to where we started. But I could talk Definitely. More if you have questions.
I think we hit everything that I wanted to do. Yeah, we got that you're an author, a director, punk rocker, radio show host. Yeah, I think we hit everything. So that was super interesting. One thing that maybe people would like to hear. So you said that you were addicted to heroin for a while. You got clean in 2001 and that you used to smoke pot, but you're clean now.
Yeah.
And that's one thing.
Yeah. I actually had to, I actually had to do a piss test the other day and it really pissed me off. I don't think I've ever had to do a piss test. Maybe when I went through rehab, I went through outpatient rehab, but I don't think so. I had to piss once at the methadone clinic. I had to piss in a cup when I first signed up there, but that was back when I was trying to get off heroin, like in 89 or something. But, like I'm on all the, I got really sick about a year ago and I've been dealing with a lot of weird illnesses and lung stuff and asthma stuff and allergy stuff and sleep apnea stuff and intestinal issues over the past year. And it's really weird because it was like, I was pretty darn healthy, you know, up until like a year ago, I started getting sick and I've been just like living in doctor's offices since then. And I'm on a bunch of life-saving medications that are also like have a lot of bad side effects. And one of the things that I'm on is called prednisone, which is a steroid. It's not the kind that build muscle. It's not anabolic steroid. It's the other kind that basically enabled me to breathe when I was having really bad asthma. And I don't need that anymore because I'm dealing with the asthma in other ways. But prednisone is addictive in a weird way. It's basically your body gets used to it to the point where you stop creating your adrenal glands shut down if you go cold turkey off of prednisone. And I'm on 30 milligrams a day and I've tried to wean off of it and gotten sick every time I got down to like 20 milligrams. But now that I'm on the CPAP and I'm on this, you know, the machine at night, and I'm on this twice a month injection called Xolair, I think I'm going to be able to wean off it. So I'm going down like 2.5 milligrams a week. So it's going to take me like a couple months to get off of it, but it's really, really bad for you. I've gained a bunch of weight. It's bad for your teeth. It's bad for your bones. So it's weird. Like I haven't been, you know, addicted to anything since I got off heroin, but now I'm addicted in a different way. Like heroin's addictive in that if you stop taking it, you get sick and you feel miserable. Like, you know, you want the high of it. There's not really much of a high with this steroid. There is a little bit. The first time you use it, it makes you just have a lot of energy. But at this point, it's just maintenance for me. And the doctor is weaning, you know, I'm with medical supervision. I'm being weaned off of it. Okay. I lost my brain fart, which is another symptom of prednisone. But okay. So I remember. So one of the side effects of it is like really like dangerously high blood pressure. And I was in the doctor's office the other day getting my Xolair shot. And, you know, doctors, whenever you go in there, they take your temperature and they, you know, listen to your heart and they take your blood pressure. It's what they do every time you go in, because those three things are kind of like, you know, generally if those three things are within range, you're probably okay. And if they're not, they have to look for other things. So my blood pressure was really high. I went in there the other day and it was, 184 over 104, which is like just a couple, like basically if it'd been 2 points higher, they probably would have sent me to the hospital. So basically like on the spot, like I didn't even see the doctor. The nurse just went in, talked to the doctor. He was busy with another patient, came back and she called in a prescription for me for blood pressure medicine and said I had to go upstairs to the lab and pee in a cup or they wouldn't fill the prescription. Mm-hmm. Oh, they didn't say they wouldn't fill the prescription, but like, you know, and James Babb asked me like, well, why did you agree to that? And it's like, well, because I didn't want to get my blood pressure higher by getting in a big argument with them. You know, when my blood pressure was about to kill me, you know, I was just like, okay, I'll do it. So I went upstairs and I had to sit for like 20 minutes till I had to pee. I just sat there drinking water and watching Trailer Park Boys episodes on my chromed robot turd and peed in a cup. And of course it all came back negative, but I was kind of insulted. But then I really thought about it. And, you know, I remember, like, you know, drugs can affect your blood pressure, and, you know, hard drug users almost always lie because, you know, government, because if they don't lie, they're going to lose their job and end up in jail. So, yep.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly right. And the reason why I brought that up is I actually wrote a paper for school. It was like last year, and it was about the prohibition of heroin and like cocaine or something. And one of my favorite Freedom Fiends quotes, I don't remember. I knew when I talked to you about it, I didn't know who exactly said it. I knew you had said it before, but we didn't know who came up with it. But it was that one day I hope that heroin will be available in vending machines. And that's just a classic fiend.
Well, no, there's two different quotes. I didn't make up either of them, but I'm fond of saying them all the time to the point where people probably think that I made them up. You know, I don't deny that someone else made them up, but I spout them off as common knowledge. And I guess people think I made them up. One is, I think that heroin should be legally available in vending machines in front of middle schools, as long as the vending machines are privately owned and operated. I have no idea who said that, but I like to quote that. And the other one, I think, is from that guy, Vic Sawipowicz. Is that his name? He's a African, white South African liberty blogger, I think, said something to the effect of cocaine and heroin should be freely sold without regulation in Walmart, but hopefully in a different aisle from the sugar and flour to avoid confusion. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was great. Yeah. I don't have anything else, Michael. So, thanks for coming on.
Cool, man. I'll, get this file to you soon.
All right. Sweet.
Worms.
Okay. I need to go clean up my basement.
Thank you for your wormness.
Worms.
I hope you guys enjoyed that show. Like we talked about, the Freedom Fiends has been extremely instrumental in my life. It's been an honor working with Michael, and I wouldn't be here talking to you without him. The opportunity to speak on terrestrial commercial radio at 15 was amazing, and the help he gave me is what has made this a successful podcast in my mind. I started listening to the Freedom Fiends around Christmas, a bit afterwards. I remember wearing a brand new pair of headphones while listening to them for the first time. I thought, these guys are all right, but anarchy? No way. It took me about 3 months, I think, to change my mind. And I've been a fan for over 3 years now. I've been an anarchist for almost 3 years, I guess. Coming up somewhere is my anarchy birthday. I've been a fan of the Freedom Fiends for about 3 years now. I've been a co-host for almost a year and a half. I think I've improved in many ways. And some of it has to do with the encouragement Michael has given me. I really have to thank Michael for everything. For this show. So thank you, Michael. I have to thank Eric, you know who you are, for fixing the last episode with Ian Freeman for me. I uploaded the fixed version a few days ago. Now you don't have to wear both headphones to get the whole conversation. So thank you, Eric. There are many, many more people I could thank, but it did take a long time to get it all out. So I'm going to just say that I'm grateful for everybody in my life. Especially you guys, you the listeners. It's a huge ego inflation to know that there are over 100 of you guys. I looked at my analytics recently. There's quite a few more than 100, and that's awesome. So thank you guys for listening. If you'd like to help out the show, the best thing you could do is write a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. That would be a Christmas present I would love. iTunes reviews and likes on Podomatic help us reach more people who aren't familiar with a lot of the ideas that we talk about on this show. Sharing on social media also helps. You can find the Anarcho-Yakitalism podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podomatic, the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.fm, and an-yak.com. That's an-yak.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Hazelton, or like us on Facebook on the Anarcho-Yakitalism podcast page. Again, thank you all for listening. Hope you have happy holidays, whether you're Muslim, Christian, pagan, Jewish, one of the 13 Zoroastrians that exist in the world. I'm kidding there. I know there are more. Or whatever. I don't dig any of it, but I'm going to have fun, and I hope you do too.
Nick Hazelton with the Narco-Yakitalism.